one of the great, great misunderstandings of this war, is that somehow Putin is the only decision maker in all of this. You know, when you look at the voices on this in Russia, Putin comes across as a moderate. I mean, the pressure on him is coming from his right. It's from hardliners. It's from people who are saying, you're not doing enough. You're not being strong enough. You're putting us into a bad position here by not finishing this war sooner, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there is always a consequence to foreign war. There always is. I mean, like, whether it appears now or appears like in the future in some unforeseen or unexpected manner, there are consequences to foreign wars. But you also have this war being a popular war. And so where I see the danger with this going is the hope that it gives the Europeans and many Americans that if we keep hammering at this, they look at individual items, right? They look at the trees and not the forest, if you will. So they say, oh, look, we've reduced Russian oil refining capacity by 40% or whatever the number is. Man, they are really going to be hurting. It's a matter of time until their revenues and their government starts dropping. They have to cut services to their people. The people are going to be upset, and then they're going to clamor for the war to end, and then Putin's government's going to fall apart, and then this is how we win this thing. When that is not what's happening, certainly there are parts of the Russian economy that are not doing so well, but there are other parts that are doing very well. One of the things about this war that should, or about this whole episode that should really be noted by the West, is not just the resilience of the Russian economy, but their capacity to expand it, their capacity to build it and grow it, whether it be finding new trading partners or dramatically increasing their trade with other nations, or the fact that, yeah, I mean, if you went back to Russia 2 years ago, 3 years ago, because of the sanctions, there was stuff missing on their store shelves. But you talk to Russians now, people who are there now, they'll tell you, no, we filled it all. We're either importing it from other countries or we're making it ourselves. I mean, so the resilience here of the Russian economy, Russian industry, and the ability of the Russian leadership to plan for this and execute it to ensure that their economy, even as it was under, 19 rounds of sanctions now from the West, yeah, something that's supposed to crash the Russian economy. Actually, you saw the opposite.
Bone-crushing sanctions.
Right. But yeah, exactly. You saw the opposite of that, actually. You saw an overheating Russian economy for a few years. And so they had some inflation, and that inflation's going down. But overall, in terms of the health of the Russian economy, their debt to GDP ratio, their revenue, you know, not many years ago, 10 years ago or so, half of Russian government revenue came from oil and gas. And now it's only about 20% or so. It shows how the Russian leadership has been quite effective. Again, not just at ensuring that their economy and their industry is resilient from attacks from the West, but to grow it and expand it and to make it even more powerful. And, you know, and I say this not as someone who is cheerleading for Russia, but as someone who's trying to get Western leaders to understand where they're putting themselves here, what they are confronting. Look, you had the numbers last month of Russian drones that were launched into Ukraine, and I think it was almost 6,000. And then you had the numbers from Ukraine into Russia, and it's about 2,500. It's about the 3.5 years of war. With all the pronouncements from the West, from the Americans and the Europeans about how we are going to give Ukraine everything they need to win this war, and we're going to expand our industrial capacity, we're going to build out our armament factories, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to become a new arsenal for democracy, all the rhetoric that went with it. 3.5 years later, you've got Russia able to send about 2.5 times more drones into Ukraine than Ukraine can send into Russia. Right. I mean, so this is a fight just on the industrial side that the West has demonstrated it can't win, let alone the fact that we know, thanks to that really great story. I mean, it's clear. I mean, if the New York Times publishes something like this, you know, this is where it happens. This is the beauty of having stenographers for the U.S. government like the New York Times. So, right. I mean, so that we know, like, because you and I, we could say 2 years ago, 3 years ago, the American generals are the ones who are waging this war, not the Ukrainian generals. And people are like, OK, yeah, whatever, ho, whatever, Davis. But when the Times, as they did back in March or April this year, published that massive story on how particularly, say, the offensive, the Ukrainian offensive of 23 was led by American officers in Wiesbaden, Germany. Hey, you know, that's the way it was. You know, if the Times publishes something like that with the full approval of the American government, you know, for whatever reasons why the Pentagon and the White House wanted that information out there, they put it out there. And so we've seen. So it's not only just the fact that we can't win this war because our industry, our economy can't measure up to the Russians. It's also, too, our leadership can't measure up to the Russians.
Earlier today, I did a whole show on this, so I won't repeat a lot of that, but I would like your comment on this. There is a piece today published by the Atlantic Council, dispatched from Ukraine. The path to a durable peace is emerging. And in this piece, the author, who is the chief president and CEO of the organization, goes on to say basically that some of the interesting points here, that they, now that we realize that Russia cannot win on the ground, we're looking for some other things here. And they want a just and durable peace. And they define that as everything that's in Zelensky's favor. And it is totally divorced from reality. Doesn't even address the Russian side of this. The only thing that's come close to being talked about here that's a valid is that they talk about the Ukraine drone capacity, which is legitimate and it's powerful, but they don't put it in context. They don't see what the Russians, and they give the impression, if not the outright statement, that Putin can be forced into a peace. What do you say when you see stuff like this?
I think that his phrasing is off the mark. I mean, if he Russia cannot win on the ground, I think is not the right way to describe it. It'd be Russia cannot lose on the ground. You know, I mean, like
just a slight variation of that. That's right, all. Right.
But I mean, that doesn't mean that Russia could, you know, win. You know, I mean, it's a sense that Russia can't lose and Ukraine can't win. That's the formulation that war has been the entire 3.5 years and will continue that way, where Russia cannot lose and Ukraine cannot win. I mean, we've talked before my view on what would a Russian win look like. You know, what a collapsed Ukrainian government, millions of people who are now refugees. Many of them will go into Russia themselves. They've already absorbed a million refugees or more. Russia, you know, the eastern part of Ukraine is devastated. It's depopulated. It's deindustrialized because everything's been destroyed. Right? You know, and then now you've got across the river from them, you know, even if the Russians move forward and take buffer zones that they've talked about west of the four prime oblasts, what are you talking about? A failed Ukrainian state in the middle of Europe? You're talking about Syria? You're talking about Afghanistan in the middle of Europe? Oh, you know what I mean? Like, how is that a win for the Russians just as much as how would that be a win for anybody? So that's been my view on, like, the strategic error of the Russians here. Once they didn't achieve what they tried to achieve early on the world war, in the first few weeks of the war, through forcing a negotiated settlement, which I believe was their objective, once that occurred, they're now stuck. And so the problem is that we get back to saying before about, and what I think Kagan is trying to push here, when you're taking the trees and not the forest, when they're taking details, Russian oil capacity, oil refining capacity is down 40% or whatever the number is, right? They're taking that and they're running with it. And they're saying, look, this is working. This war is working. As you said, he's pointing to Russia, Ukraine's expanded drone production capabilities. As you said, very true. It's significant. It causes a lot of difficulties for the Russians on tactical and operational levels. But it's not taken or understood in the overall context of the war. Like, you know, especially what are the Russians doing? You know, how else is their economy behaving? Where does the Russian population see this war? Where is public opinion in Russia on this war? And what type of pressure is being put onto Putin? It's completely the opposite of the way Kagan and others are describing the circumstances. So the danger in all this, of course, is it gives this idea, this fantasy that the war can be won. And I think certainly the war can be continued. I think you run into the danger of Ukraine collapsing, whether it be a military collapse or a civilian government economy collapse. And I put equal money on which one would come first. You know, and so there's that danger. But I think that the Europeans and many Americans view this as, well, look, we've done it before. As long as we keep the fire hose, as long as the money keeps going in, the balloon will stay inflated. And if we can just get the Ukrainians to lower their draft age, right, and start recruiting 18 and 19 and 20 year olds, then they'll have another half generation to put into this war. We could keep the balloon inflated. We can, you know, like that crazy armed balloon you see outside of car dealerships, right? You can keep that thing upright and wiggling around and dancing. I mean, that's basically what they believe they can accomplish here. And then they hope for some, deus ex machina. They hope for something that Putin has a stroke or something like that, or that a coup does occur or something, even though, as we've discussed, if that was to happen, the results would be the opposite in terms of who will come into power.
Right.
I want to
go back to something you said just a second ago, to see if you can give a little bit more depth on what you intend by that. Cause you said that Russia basically can't get a real win because they're stuck strategically and that they would have a failed state on their border. But in a certain sense, wouldn't that be a victory for the Russian side because they have a quasi-state that's defunct and that can no longer pose a threat to them? And that might even be a positive thing from Russia.
It could be. But I think the risk, though, of having a failed state with all those weapons, with essentially warlords, you know, with who in Ukraine over the last years, what group has performed best politically in terms of actually getting hold of power, putting themselves in positions of power, right? It's the right wing in Ukraine. It's the Nazis that the Russians complain about and are afraid about. They're the ones in the best positions now. So if you had a fractured state, a failed state, those who would benefit most would be those who are still the most hostile to the Russians. And it just would be an ugly, awful mess that be the, you know, the opposite of the stability that I think anybody wants to see there, including the Russians. I mean, certainly they'd have to then garrison. And I don't think this was their objective, say almost four years ago, was to have to garrison that eastern part of Ukraine and essentially be in this position where they are now the dream of every aspiring American and European general is to be the general who takes back the Donbass, right? To be the Richard the Lionheart of, you know, the modern age, right? That the Donbass is now the new Jerusalem that we have to take back, you know? So I think they have put themselves into that position. Same time too, weighing everything else, you know, it's easy for me to say that sitting here. I'm not the one who's concerned with their national security matters as they are. So I can understand why they made that decision. I'll criticize it, but I also understand why they felt like that was the best option for them. But, you know, I mean, certainly, you know, there's no way I see without a negotiated settlement. And through a negotiated settlement, I feel that the Russians can be victorious, right? That through a negotiated settlement where they do achieve that degree of Ukrainian neutrality, which would actually lead to a stabilized Europe militarily, just as Finnish neutrality and Austrian neutrality did, following World War II. So I think there's that possibility. Getting to a negotiated settlement, as you know, we both know now at this point, the road to that is looking really bad. You know,
it is. You mentioned people looking back and kind of hearkening back to history. Well, as it turns out, Vladimir Putin did that very thing today at the CIS, Commonwealth of Independent States, when he made a comment connecting his current military to Peter the Great.
I think it's also clear, because it was Peter the Great who laid the foundations of the modern Russian state, whatever its name, the Russian Empire, the Soviet Union. But it was Peter the Great who laid the foundations, the fundamental foundations. Our military as a whole, both our commanders and our soldiers and officers on the ground, essentially defend what Peter the Great created. and then his successors strengthened him. Russia's fate has unfolded differently over time. It has grown. Under Catherine the Great, it even has a tomb right next to Peter the Great. In fact, Russia made the greatest territorial acquisitions, as is well known. So, we paid tribute to those people who made a unique, fundamental contribution to the development of our state. Well, and then I simply held a meeting with my military colleagues, and they reported to me on the situation on each sector of the front, each one for which they are specifically responsible.
So what message do you think, if any, that was intended for? And we'll look at two different audiences. One is the domestic audience, and number two is the European audience, because he's saying, look, we had all these territorial conquests under Peter the Great, under Catherine, and now then here's my current military, and we are advancing both on the ground and in the air. What do you think?
Well, I think, domestically, it's a great recruiting speech, right? It hearkens to your forefathers. It hearkens to your ancestors. It hearkens to those who built and established Russia, who's defended it over the centuries. You know, I think that helps drive, along with their very large bonuses and pay packages for their soldiers, you know, a Russian military that is not facing any manpower difficulties that I'm aware of, right? It's doing quite well that way.
Right.
3.5 years into the war, you could call it a foreign war. I call it that. I know many Russians don't view it that way. You'd expect maybe the army to be slowing down a bit in terms of how many people are pulling in, and no, they've been expanding it. And then for the Europeans, I think it's the same type of usage of history that we've seen Vladimir Putin use before. You know, this just trying to be reasonable with the Europeans in the sense of recall your past, recall your experiences, you know, recall what has happened in terms of previous wars, how well they've gone, how well they've failed, you know, how far they failed to advance, how they ultimately did fail, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We can point to, you know, a half dozen examples, you know, and trying just to use that type of historical example that Putin is saying, it's just not the strength of my army. It's just not the strength of our economy. It's the resilience and the spirit of our people here that has always existed for the Russian people. And I think that's what he's trying to get across to the Europeans. The Europeans, of course, don't seem interested in listening to anyone.
The message definitely fallen on deaf ears, yeah. But they keep giving the message. And as a matter of fact, earlier this week, speaking of the military, you had Valery Gerasimov, the commander of the Russian armed forces, also gave an update to Putin on the front lines.
The enemy has concentrated its main efforts on stabilizing the situation in crisis areas of the front in order to slow down our advance. The North troop grouping is operating along the border zone and continues to carry out tasks to create a security belt in the Kharkiv and Sumy regions of Ukraine. Its units are also successfully advancing in the southern part of Volchansk. The West grouping is completing the rout of the enemy in the southern districts of Kupiansk, successfully advancing in the Krasno-Liman direction, and the liberation of the settlement of Yampol continues, most of which is under our forces' control. The troops of the southern grouping, despite the enemy's stubborn resistance, are advancing through fierce fighting in the cities of Seversk and Konstantinovka.
And by the way, for all those who may have wondered, Gerasimov was not suddenly speaking English. That is AI translation, which has remarkable technological capabilities where they actually change the movements of his mouth to match the English words. Pretty remarkable stuff there. But the bigger issue there, look, he's not wrong. And when you take a look at the current battle map of today, you see the stuff that he's saying there, it's valid. It's on the map. I mean, it continues to move to the west. Ukraine continues to lose men. Unlike the Russians, which you just pointed out, they don't have a pipeline, no matter stealing people off the ground or troops or money, anything else, which they do try some of that. They don't have enough manpower. So whether you're talking about in the air that we started off here or on the ground, I don't see any path to continue having this fantasy like the Atlantic Council did, that there's going to be some positive outcome for the Ukraine side.
No. I mean, best case for the Ukrainians is that they're able to hold on again because of the infusion of money and armaments from the West, and those are both doubtful. You know, I'm trying to understand the discussions in Brussels or that, you know, in say New York or the White House among the Americans who think that there is a path forward here. You know, the best case I can estimate is that Ukraine hangs on, you know, and they slowly lose land, you know, and that it's not dramatic and it takes, you know, it takes another year and a half or whatever for the rest of Donetsk to be seized or something, you know, like that's the best case. And that is the best case, you know, and, you know, the failure of, I think, the West to understand the Russians' goals and objectives in this, that it was never about the conquest of all of Ukraine. Again, it was about Russia's national security interests, as well as you know, as it changes in 2022, taking the four provinces or oblasts of eastern Ukraine, and that's it. So, yeah, I don't understand this idea of a pathway forward, where they think it's going to come from. The fact that it continues to be spoken about in a way that receives attention, that it's that's, you know, entire conferences are centered around it. Yeah, I just was reading about the IMF report from a month or so ago that details the state of the Ukrainian economy, the state of Ukrainian government finances. And again, they're going to be $70 billion short. That money has to come in or else they'll be, you know, they'll go bankrupt and everything will crash. And, you know, you looked at the estimation that IMF have been using for the last few years. Their estimates were all based upon the war ending this year. Their estimates, their economists were utilizing the information they received from their geopolitical peers who were advised by, retired military officers and strategists at places like the Institute for Study of War and the Atlantic Council and, you know, the Royal Uniformed Services Institute and so on and so forth, right? That the war would be over by 2025. By 2025, Ukraine would have won this war. So, I mean, and that's the analysis that informed the IMF's decisions on Ukrainian borrowing, right? That is the at the top level of the world monetary, economic, and financial order sits organizations like the IMF that make incredibly important decisions and then execute on those decisions based upon the fact that people like General Ben Hodges is saying the war is going to be over in 2025, or that Fred Kagan believes there is a pathway to win this war, that the Russians can't win on the ground or the Ukrainians can, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Their commentary has a much greater effect than simply causing our ears to bleed because they're repeating this nonsense nonstop on Fox or CNN or quoted in the Journal or whatever. It actually does inform really important decisions. So when the IMF says, okay, Ukraine only needs a $15 billion loan to get them through 2025 and then the war is going to be over, well, there we go. That then puts you in a position where, holy cow, we're wrong. And you know how institutions like this work. They won't admit that they're wrong until the very last moment.
Or even after the last moment.
Even after the worst moment. And so now the fact where like Ukraine's budget gap is, you know, this ugly, roaring, hell hole coming, you know, in the ground in front of you. Well, okay, now all of a sudden we need $70 billion. Where's it going to come from? And that's why you've seen in the last week or two this renewed calls from the Europeans. We're just going to take it from the frozen Russian assets. You know, that's illegal, but also, too, the Russians have plenty of Western assets. Do you want to go in a tit for tat that way then, you know? But the now, of course, as well, but by 2027, Ukraine will win. And at that point, Russia will have to pay off all this loans. That's the whole thing. So people who aren't familiar, the European Union is moving forward and providing a $160 billion loan to Ukraine. This one, to show how mad the Europeans are, the commissioner, the European Commission, the budget director has said that this $160 billion loan won't count in the accounting stats towards European budget deficits, because the Russians will have to pay this money back in the future when they lose the war. So that's how mad
okay
right now, right? Their head of budget for the EC is saying that we're not going to put this $160 billion on the ledger because Ukraine's going to win this war. And then as a result of their victory, the Russians are going to be forced to pay reparations, and then they will pay back this loan. That's the madness that we're dealing with here, that you can't even have people do sound accounting, that they're that you know, when it comes to like measuring the European overall health as well as individual nations' health, they're willing to just throw everything out the window because they're so blinded by the fever dream of defeating the Russians in war.
Well, that's you could die from that fever, by the way, if you don't get it solved pretty quickly. And certainly a lot of Ukrainians will die in all seriousness.
Yeah, exactly. And they are dying. And a lot of Russians are dying. And the expansion of this war, you opened with the escalation on the attacks on energy infrastructure. And I think this is proving the point made by those who say, you know what, the Ukraine-Russia war is eventually going to resemble the Iran-Iraq war, where there won't be a lot of movement on the ground and neither side can deal a knockout punch. I'm not really so sure about that with the Ukrainians right now because of the state of their manpower issues with their army and also their economic health. They may face collapse, but it's going to turn into, as the Iran-Iraq war turned into, while they still had terrible fighting on the front lines, it turned into what was called the War of the Cities, where they just launched missiles at one another's cities. And that's essentially what we're seeing developing in this war, both sides trying to hit each other in rear areas to try and bring about either have a negative impact on the country's ability to fight the war or put pressure on their citizenry. And to be fair, we've really not seen as much from the Russians as we could expect to see. The Russians really haven't hit civilian infrastructure. They've hit the energy infrastructure. They've hit some bridges, but not a lot of what we would call civilian infrastructure. Yeah. They've hit nothing. When you compare it to the Israelis, they've hit absolutely nothing. And the number of Ukrainian civilians killed, while still, as anyone would think, you know, would rightly think, terrible, it's still a fraction of what we've seen in terms of casualties, say, of civilians in any of the Middle Eastern wars or any of the African wars. Was it a month ago, you had that Ukrainian drone hit a government building in Kyiv. And that was the first time a Ukrainian government non-military building had been hit by the Russians. And even the mayor of Kyiv, Klitschko, you know, he said that was an accident. The drone either got hit by something or got jammed and it crashed into the government building. So we've not even seen the Russians go after, right, the infrastructure.
And some people have been saying that a lot lately on the Russian side. That's one of the points of anger. Yeah. Listen, I'm sorry. Right. I'm going to have to shift gears here pretty much, or we're going to run out of time. Before I leave this topic, though, there was one interesting video that came out of the White House this morning, not from President Trump, but from the First Lady.
Much has unfolded since President Putin received my letter last August. He responded in writing, signaling a willingness to engage with me directly and outlining details regarding the Ukrainian children residing in Russia. And since then, President Putin and I have had an open channel of communication regarding the welfare of these children. For the past 3 months, both sides have participated in several back-channel meetings and calls, all in good faith. We have agreed to cooperate with each other for the benefit of all people involved in this war. 8 children have been rejoined with their families during the past 24 hours.
It's kind of a good story. It's a nice story that they've been talking, because anything that's going to help move anything towards peace is good. 8 children allegedly came back, but the claim is that there is like 20 or 30,000 of them. And the Russians say, well, there actually aren't any for various reasons. I'm not sure where these 8 came from, but what do you make of that?
Yeah, I've had a great difficulty following this story for the last few years. Various estimates are put out there. I don't believe either side So it's kind of hard to take the word of the Russians or the Ukrainians on this. The consequences of war, you're going to have people separated, whether it was a planned kidnapping, abduction of tens of thousands of children by the Russians, or it was something less sinister. I don't really know, but I agree, though, with you, Danny, in a sense that any type of discussion, any type of deals, any type of action that has results, as Melania Trump is describing, is welcome. And it demonstrates that both sides can work together. I mean, and this has been the point made over and over again. You can talk to the Russians. You don't have to like them, but you can negotiate with them. We've seen dozens of prisoner of war exchanges. We the Black Sea grain deal, which ultimately has fallen apart. But, that held, for quite a while. Right. And my reading of that is that it didn't fail. It wasn't the fall of the Russians that it failed. There are opportunities here that can be where good faith can be shown, where relationships can be established, and then those can be built upon to grow into negotiations. Particularly now, we're at this point where it seems that both sides are willing to walk away from negotiations. The comments from the Russian deputy foreign minister this week were very disappointing, understandable, but very disappointing.
Sergei Ryabkov said that he felt that all the momentum from Alaska had been played out and was gone. Right.
Yeah. And even today, Vladimir Putin said about the New START treaty. Because he had offered a couple weeks ago now, hey, let's extend this New START, because New START, the arms control deal that keeps Russian and U.S. Warheads capped at about 1,500 each. That's set to expire in February. And, the explosion, the arms race that's going to come from that, we're already in an arms race, but the explosion that's going to come from that is going to be massive. And Vladimir Putin a couple weeks ago said, let's extend it for another year.
Yeah.
And initially the White House said, that sounds like a good idea. But as far as we know, the Americans in 2 weeks' time have not responded at all to the Russians. And the Russian president just today said, if they want to, that's great. But if they don't want to extend it, no big deal. We're building new weapons, lots of new weapons, and we're going to be okay. I mean, so this is a terrible spot that where we may have had some very cautious hope, several months ago. I think that's more or less going away.